When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
You're digging the Rock and Roll Heaven podcast with LD, Will the Thrill, and TJ2.
Hey guys, welcome to Rock and Roll Heaven, the podcast where we talk about the lives, careers, and deaths of famous musicians. I am your host, LD, along with me for the ride, as always, is Will the Thrill.
Greetings and salutations.
I'm sorry, did I take you off task?
How so?
You look like you were like checking out your phone. Do you have something better that you need to be doing?
No. I was just getting ready to make notes. I was being a good student.
Okay.
And thereby opening my beer as well.
And what are you drinking?
Well, it's important to note that for the next few episodes, I have treated myself to a pack from one specific brewery. LD, would you like to read the name of that brewery, please?
It is. No.
She can't do it. The next few cocktails will come to you compliments of the Belching Beaver Brewery, based in Oceanside, California, near San Diego.
I'm six.
Yes, you are. So that's today. I will be drinking the Ohms Pale Ale, Deftones Ohms Pale Ale, which LD selected by the can, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
It's got one of those rainbow fragmented jobs where if you turn it in the light, you see different colors.
Yes.
And it is a pale ale. So Nice. We're going to be diving into that today.
And then the man with the plan on the other side of the land, Mr. TJ2, the deuce.
That's done. Hang on.
There it is.
Bitch did not want to open.
I'm just waiting for the day you shotgun a beer.
With a shotgun.
Today might be the day.
Yeah.
By the way, real quick, Freehouse Brewery Battery Brown Ale.
Ooh.
Okay.
Nice.
Is that dark? Mm-hmm. Nice.
Brown. Quite, yes. And it's a product of North Charleston, South Carolina.
As always, I'm drinking Tiesta tea, the nutty almond, because it is a stress reliever and it's really nice and I like it. So pick up your nutty almond tea at TiestaTea.com and use the promo code ROCKHEAVEN15 to get 15% off your order. Like always, live loose, baby.
Woo.
And so we are just, I mean, like a heads up to our audience. We're recording this incredibly early. All will be revealed in time, children, but for right now we're actually recording a lot of episodes ahead of time, so we do have some deaths that we have to report. Now by the time this episode comes out, I do believe it will be 2 weeks gone, and this will have already been well and truly put on our Facebook page and our Instagram and all of our social media stuff. So we do have a few deaths that we need to report, not 10 like last week, because or 2 weeks ago.
That was bananas.
That was ridiculous. So this week we had Ralph Emery. He was a country music DJ and a TV host, and he was 88 years old.
I completely missed that Ralph Emery died. Wow.
Yes. He died of natural causes. He was surrounded by his family at Nashville's TriStar Centennial Medical Center. And Yeah, he passed away at the age of 88.
He was like a host on TNN, but back when that actually still was stood for the National Network instead of whatever it is now. And he was on like every show, it seemed like. Somehow. Really? Yeah. Somehow Ralph Emery hosted every single show that they had.
So it's kind of like the generation before is Ryan Seacrest.
Right.
Sort of. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, he will be missed.
Rockin' New Year's Eve with Ralph Emery.
And then we have Rachel Nagy.
Yeah.
She was the singer of the Michigan garage rock band, the Detroit Cobras. She ended up passing, I believe, on January the 14th or 15th. Does not have a cause of death that has been released yet.
She couldn't have been that old either.
No. Fred Parris died. He was the singer on the In the Still of the Night song, which I'm sure everyone knows because it is one of doo-wop's most memorable songs. Mm. He was 85 and he had a brief illness. He passed away on Friday the 14th. It's actually unclear when he died. They just reported his death on their Facebook page, the group that he belonged to, for the Five Satins. The Five Satins were the ones that did In the Still of the Night, which I'm sure everyone knows. And then, do we have one more?
Things usually happen in threes.
Yeah, you know, I think that's all I have to report. If I did miss one, guys, I'm very sorry, but like always, our hearts and our thoughts and our prayers go out to their friends and family. We know what it is like to lose a loved one, and you know, we pray for comfort for you guys. Do we have any other news?
Not really.
Excellent. Well, actually, TJ, you want to talk about what's happening at your house right now?
Does
it never happen?
My house?
Yes.
Okay. So as we're recording this, there's a winter storm battering the southeastern United States. And we had about an inch and a half, 2 inches of snow where I live. Not a huge amount, but it's been sleeting now for about 7 hours.
Jeez.
On top of the snow that's fallen. So it's a frozen wonderland. And it's bucolic and it's beautiful. And I hate it. And I wish it would melt and leave me alone.
That's going to make your roads a nightmare.
Well, fun thing is we actually on our coast have our own shit to deal with.
Oh, yeah.
We had tsunami warnings.
Yeah,
good grief.
Because a volcano erupted near Tonga and sent massive tsunami waves toward the West Coast. So, oh, and by the way, on Betty White's birthday, the day after Betty White's birthday, a giant asteroid is supposed to come relatively close to the Earth. So if you guys don't hear this episode, it's because we all died.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's because Earth was knocked off its axis and spun us into a different dimension, one that probably would be bereft of oxygen or proper heat and light to support any form of life. So we're totally wasting our final days recording an episode you'll never hear.
The end of the night, and here we are.
Maybe I shouldn't drink this battery brown ale quite so fast.
Yes, slow down, man.
Enjoy the little things, kids. That's what we're trying to say.
All right. So jumping back into Michael Jackson.
Is that who we're covering?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
There's not an end in sight right now. I just wrote another episode, and literally it is about one performance.
Yep. Well, to be fair, the guy did a lot. I mean, he had a, 40 plus year career in music. And
everything he did was super interesting. Like, he spent time in his kitchen and I'm like, rapt. I'm like, this is amazing.
And it all ended up on the world stage. That's the thing. Like you said, he made pancakes and the world knew about it.
That's why we had pancakes this morning. All right. In August of 1982, Michael began work with Quincy Jones on a new album at the Westlake Studios in Los Angeles. The album would be entitled Thriller. So if you guys know anything about me and know anything about how I said this episode is about one thing, guess what it's going to be about, kids? Thriller.
Do go on. I'm intrigued. This Thriller you speak of.
It had a budget of about $750,000 to produce and 9 songs carefully selected by Michael. So he went through 300 songs and picked out 9 of them.
Jeez.
9. 300, 9. Wow. 300, 9. For Michael's book, he said, looking back, I can view the whole tapestry and see how off the wall prepared me for the work that we would do on the album. And that album would become Thriller. Quincy and Ron Temperton and many of the musicians who played on Off the Wall helped me realize that dream that I'd had for a long time. Off the Wall also sold 6 million copies in this country, but I wanted to make an album that would be even bigger. Ever since he was a kid, he had dreamed of creating the biggest selling album of all time. He can remember going swimming as a child and making a wish before he jumped into the pool. And you have to remember, he grew up knowing the industry and understanding the goals and what would be and would not be possible. So you guys ready for a little fun fact?
Fun fact.
All right. Well, let's actually do a little fun question. Okay. Would you guys like to know what the other 9 top 10 albums are of all time, since we already know what number one is going to be?
Well, number two is clearly Cookie Puss. I mean,
right.
Right.
And I think Van Halen 3 is right after that.
Yep. And just a single.
Actually, I think I know a couple of them. Eagles Greatest Hits Volume 1 has always been tit for tat with Thriller.
This is international. So there was an article that came out. I'm not really sure when. I should have double checked that. But there was an article came out that said, because of the re-release of their greatest hits, basically kind of at the same time that Michael Jackson had passed away, it actually surpassed Thriller in numbers in America.
Right.
But international, the Eagles.
Oh, Eagles. Okay.
But international, Thriller is still the number one selling album of all time. However, to this list, the Eagles are actually number 7. Hmm. So I'm going to, do you want it 10 to 2 or do you want it 2 to 10? I'll give them to you.
I like 10 to 2.
10 to 2.
Yeah.
All right. Number 10, Fleetwood Mac, Rumors.
Rumors. Yep.
Nice.
Number 9, Saturday Night Fever, but not the highest charting soundtrack that we will talk about in this list.
Right.
So that was the Fueled by the Bee Gees, for those who don't know.
There are 2 soundtracks, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
This one truly shocked me. Come On Over by Shania Twain.
Wow.
Oh, it doesn't shock me. No, that was a mammoth worldwide hit with, God, she must have put out 6-7 singles from that thing.
Jeez.
I remember it being big. I just didn't remember it being that
top 10 all time big. Yeah.
Was that Man, I Feel Like a Woman? And
I think
that,
yes.
Okay.
It was.
Okay.
However,
that don't impress me much. And
yes.
And stuff like that.
However, my favorite song by her, No One Needs to Know, was actually on the Twister soundtrack. Just FYI. Anyway, number 7 is the Eagles with their greatest 1971 to 1975.
Right.
Number 6 is one of my personal favorites and is the next purchase I'm going to make on vinyl, which is Bad Outta Hell.
The Loaf.
Number 5, man, we're talking about right now, Bad.
So he's got 2.
Yep.
Yeah.
Number 4. The Bodyguard.
Whitney.
Yep.
Number 3, Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd.
Which I think still holds the record for longest period of time on the charts, doesn't it?
It lasted from like 19, whatever year it was released to like...
It charted for something stupid, something ridiculous like 15, 20 straight years or something ridiculous. Just kept selling just enough every week to be on the charts for, I forget what it was. We could look it up, but seriously, it's something like 500 weeks or something just completely ridiculous.
It's so stupid. Then we've got number 2 was Back in Black by AC/DC.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, and that is a great album.
What a, oh yeah. What a, that, cause that was the first one with Brian, right?
Yep. Yep.
After
by Bond had passed and
LD's favorite member of AC/DC, right?
Freaking love him.
And you just think, gosh, they'll never find anybody with as unique a voice as Bond. They never find anybody who can. Oh, who's that guy? Yeah. Oh, never mind. They did.
Wait, was Brian the one that had appendicitis?
Yes, he was. Yep. He was writhing and screaming on stage. And, wow, this guy is great. It turns out he actually needed an appendectomy. So. Right. I got his job.
Which means he's a punk, because remember what happened when I had my appendectomy? Yeah.
I believe I made the call to take you to the hospital. I don't think at any point you brought it up.
I mean, men are such babies. So he was in the studio with Quincy and Ron, and they were working on the Thriller, and he was playing a pinball machine one day when one of them asked him, what if his album didn't do as well as Off the Wall? Will you be disappointed? He remembers feeling upset and hurt if that question was even raised. He told them that Thriller had to be better than Off the Wall. He admitted that he wanted this album to be the best-selling album of all time, and everybody laughed at him. It seemed like that was an unrealistic thing to want.
Hmm.
Now, the sessions went well and Michael was satisfied with the work. But what you have to remember is Michael puts in so much work. He is a perfectionist. He would literally work until he dropped. And as for Michael, it really helped the recording process that he did have someone that he thought was on his side. Before, it was, here is a machine that we are working with, that we're pumping this music out. And he didn't feel like anybody was on his side, especially when Joseph was in the studio with them. He would work with Quincy on Off the Wall. And because of that, he felt like he had proved himself during that time. Quincy would actually listen to what Michael would say, and that helped him accomplish what he had hoped to on that album. And he even showed more faith in Michael during the making of Thriller. He realized that Michael had the competence and experience needed to make a record. And at times he wasn't even in the studio for that reason.
Who, Quincy?
Yeah.
Oh my.
He just let Michael work.
Well, he's one of those, I mean, like Clive Davis, he had the quote Midas touch, you know,
mm-hmm.
what he put into play was going to be gold. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what a good producer does. Mm-hmm. The thing about Quincy was that he was amazing at balancing out an album, which was, you know, all about creating the right mix of up-tempo numbers and ballads. Mm-hmm. They started out working with Ron Temperton on songs from the Thriller album, which was actually originally called, Fun fact. Starlight.
Mm.
Ooh.
I will get to that. I'll get to why in a little bit. So in Michael's words, I was writing the songs myself while Quincy was listening to other people's songs and hoping to find the right one for the album. He was good at knowing what Michael would like and what would work for him. They both had the same philosophy about making albums, but they didn't believe in B-sides or album songs. They felt like every song should be able to stand on its own as a single, and they always pushed for that when they were finding songs for the album. He finished some songs on his own, but he didn't actually give them to Quincy until he saw something good come up from the other writers. The first song that Michael had was Starting Something, which he had written while they were doing Off the Wall, but he had never given it to Quincy. Sometimes he would write a song and he just couldn't bring himself to present it to a producer. While they were making Thriller, he even held out presenting Beat It for a really long time before he played it to Quincy.
Really?
Yeah. Quincy kept telling him that he needed a great rock song on the album.
Supposedly inspired Quincy to put include a rock song on Thriller by My Sharona.
The Knack.
Yeah, not the Mac.
Yeah, that's supposedly here. Upon hearing that is when Quincy was like, we need to put a rock song on here.
That's super weird because this is 3-4 years after that song came out.
At least a couple, because that came out like 79, I guess.
79. It was the number one song the day I was born.
Yeah.
My Sharona.
I get that weird, creepy song. So he finally convinced him to share what Michael had written. He was like, come on, Michael, do you have anything? Just a good rock song. Do you have anything that's like that? So he brought out Beat It and played it, and Quincy went nuts. It was the first time in a long time that Michael felt like he was on top of the world. They were about to start their work on Thriller, and Michael decided to call Paul McCartney in London to see if they wanted to collaborate. We'll see if he wanted to collaborate. That ended up producing the songs Say, Say, Say and The Girl Is Mine. Quincy, being the incredible producer he was, actually went for The Girl Is Mine as the obvious first single for Thriller. And you don't have much of a choice. When you have Paul McCartney, you actually have to release that song first because it's going to get played to death.
I believe it's a Sir Paul McCartney.
Sir Paul McCartney.
Okay. Yep.
So they had to get that one out of the way. And in Michael's words, he said, when I approached Paul, I wanted to repay the favor that he'd done for me in contributing Girlfriend to Off the Wall. I wrote The Girl Is Mine, which I knew would be right for his voice and mine working together. And we also did work on Say, 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 which we would finish up later with George Martin, the great Beatles producer.
Jeez.
So, you know, what the heck? Let's play The Girl Is Mine right now. Because like he said, you got to play it first to get it out of the way or it's going to be overexposed and overplayed. So let's enjoy The Girl Is Mine with Sir Paul McCartney.
She walks right in my dreams since I met her from the start. I'm so proud I am the only one who is special in her heart. The girl is mine. The doggone girl is mine. I know she's mine. Because the doggone girl is mine. She's yours, not mine. Sending roses and your silly dreams, really just a waste of time. Because she's mine.
she tell you I'm the one for her? 'Cause she said I blow her mind. The girl is mine. The doggone girl is mine. Don't waste your time.
I'm not gonna fight about this, okay?
Paul, I think I told you. I'm a lover, not a fighter.
I've heard it all before, Michael. She told me that I'm her forever lover, you know, don't you remember?
Well, after loving me, she said she couldn't love another.
Is that what she said?
Yeah, she said it. You keep dreaming.
I don't believe.
It is an enjoyable song.
It is.
Well, I said it's not my favorite on that album, but look at that album.
I mean. Oh, yeah. No, we are. Yeah. We are actually looking at the album right now.
I mean, if you just go track by track, you can see why it would not be my favorite on that.
If you go track by track on that album, it might be my least favorite or second least favorite. But that's least favorite song on Thriller is a pretty high bar to clear.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, fair. Now, I'm sure that a lot of our audience probably knows that Michael would eventually kind of get into some trouble-ish with Paul.
Yeah,
he'd kind of stab him in the back is what he would actually do.
Well, Michael would end up buying the ATV music publishing catalog, which included a lot of Lennon and McCartney songs.
And then he would sell them for use in, like, Nike commercials.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I'll bet you didn't know that the person that actually gave him the advice to get involved with music publishing was actually Paul himself.
Paul, yes. It was Paul who recommended, oh, you know, a great investment is...
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
My catalog. Right? Don't think about that.
Yeah. It was, not stuff I did with that band.
That was everything else.
Yeah, he was actually staying with Paul and Linda at their home in the country when Paul told him about his involvement with music publishing. He handed him a little book that had MPL printed on the cover. It was a little notebook that contained a list of all the songs Paul owned and that he had been buying the rights to those particular songs for a long time. Michael had never had that idea. So when the ATV music publishing catalog went on sale, he decided to put in a bid. So this is from an article that I will post out in the show notes, but August 14th, 1985. When Michael purchased the publishing rights to the vast majority of the Beatles catalog for a staggering $47 million, he actually outbid McCartney himself. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of background. We're going to take a little bit of a left turn because this article actually, it was very interesting. So to understand the sound business reason behind Jackson's move to take control of the publishing rights to roughly 251 Beatles composition, you have to kind of understand the basics of the music industry economics. Every time a copyrighted recording is exploited for commercial purposes, like use in movies or TVs or commercials, for instance, the party that uses that recording is required to pay a licensing fee. A portion of that fee will be paid out to the record label that issued the recording, and then the record label in turn will pay a portion of its share to the performers. Separately, a portion of the licensing fee is due to the writer of the song in question. Songwriters, even though they are the ones who might perform the songs, tend to enter into an agreement with professional music companies to manage the collection of their songwriting royalties. Now, in a typical arrangement, a publisher might take like 50% of a songwriter's royalties in exchange for handling collections and actively promoting the commercial use of the songs. John Lennon and Paul McCartney, who were the Beatles' primary songwriters, did something a little bit more complicated because what I explained probably wasn't complicated enough. That publishing agreement they signed was with a company that they were also part owners in. That company, called Northern Songs Limited, was formed in 1964 expressly to generate revenues from the growth of the catalog of Lennon and McCartney's compositions. In this way, every sale, other than commercials' use of the song Yesterday, earned Lennon and McCartney a songwriting royalty that they split with Northern Song. And part of Northern Song's share would come back to Lennon and McCartney as part owners of the company. So
they were double dipping, basically.
Kinda. It was the snake head eating the snake tail eating the snake head.
Meanwhile, Ringo's at the back door. Hello.
Hi.
Hey, mates.
Yeah.
I wrote a song about an octopus. Anybody? Okay.
Because, I mean, George was well on his way doing his own stuff by this point. So.
Yeah. In 1969, the British company Associated Television completed a messy and contentious takeover of Northern Songs, which in turn led Lennon and McCartney to pull out their contract for future compositions and sell off their own shares in the company. More than 15 years later, in 1985, ATV, which is, I think, a subdivision of Sony, prepared to sell its entire publishing catalog. McCartney anticipated purchasing it himself, only to be thwarted by Jackson, who was at the peak of his financial powers.
Because again, $47 million for Michael Jackson at that point is like, it's like buying a car. I mean, like, it's enough that you notice it, but there'll be plenty of money left at the end of the month.
Yeah. In the years afterward, the catalog allowed Jackson to remain solvent by serving as collateral for several enormous personal loans that funded his extravagant lifestyle. Okay, so in 2006, Jackson gave up his remaining interest in the catalog to Sony, one of his primary creditors. After his death, Sony took control of the full catalog. And here's... I've read that he wasn't sore about it, but I would feel sore. He didn't actually leave the catalog to Paul in his will, as many people thought he would.
Oh, interesting.
So I don't know if he was angry about that or not.
Well, by the time we get there, I mean, I think it's kind of a thing that money is actually an issue. So it maybe that's a thing he would like to have done, but he just couldn't.
Maybe.
Yeah, because I think there's a lot of reconciliation.
I'm sure we'll get to the point where he literally walks into by appointment only art galleries and spends $10 million. By literally walking through and pointing and saying, I want that and that and that and that and that, which I saw on video once. But
he wasn't eating ramen, is what we're saying.
He just right. goes to the Sistine Chapel and is like, I'll take it. Yeah. And they're like, do you want it one piece or 50?
They said, Mamma mia, it's not a for sale.
That's exactly how they sound. It's remarkable. We went there.
So
that's exactly what we
sorry to our Italian listeners.
Oh, both of them are gone.
That's a spicy meatball.
God, I'm sorry, Italy. We love your country and we want to be allowed back in.
I'm never going. It doesn't matter.
All right. So hopping back to the album, the song Billie Jean was almost called Not My Lover. Could anybody wager a guess as to why they would change the name from Billie Jean?
Does it have to do with Billie Jean King?
It actually does.
Woot!
Oh, wow.
Quincy actually thought Jackson calling the song Billie Jean would make people immediately think of Billie Jean King, who, if you guys don't know, is a famous tennis player from like the 70s and 80s, right? And she had the Battle of the Sexes with John McEnroe, didn't she?
That she did, yeah.
No. Not with John McEnroe, with Bobby Riggs.
Bobby Riggs. Okay.
That's right. Okay.
Who wasn't a professional tennis player. That would be like me challenging Venus Williams. Yeah. Let me tell you how that ends.
Probably with you having a tennis ball in
the doughboy who doesn't really play tennis gets smoked and embarrassed. That's how it turns out. But
pretty much
fair.
But now, but then also, I don't know if she started the whole league or she owned the team, but you know, I guess this qualifies as a fun fact.
Fun fact.
I think she owned the Philadelphia Freedom and got her friend Elton John to write a theme song for him. Wow. You probably heard of
Elton
John. Philadelphia Freedom.
Who is this Elton John? What is it? Is it Juan?
He's a little known pianist that wears funny hats and glasses. I'll tell you about him later.
Can you read this? Can you read that, honey?
Yeah, our Alexa just popped up with Pizza Hut ET glass.
Has arrived.
What does that even? Oh, that's the one from the. That's yay! Right. Like when you used to go to pizza and they would have the glass sets, right?
Yes, I actually ordered two of those online, Travis.
Oh my God.
That's awesome. You should, to make sure they're authentic originals, you should go lick it. If you don't get a buzz, then it's not really 1980s. Then it's It's not the good lead-based paint that they always used back in the day.
Oh, this looks, the picture of it looks lead-based. So
sweet.
And that looks lead-based, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That could exist. That's nothing else it could be.
Yeah, I'm not going to drink out of this.
Ever.
Strictly for, I can't believe we drank out of it back then.
more of a showpiece, right.
Yep.
Now, Pizza Hut was a restaurant. It was a different time.
Yeah. Remember when Pizza Hut was awesome and they had Book It?
Yes.
Which apparently Mr. Hickey did not have the Book It system in his Pizza Hut.
I don't think it went up to the Northeast. It may not have.
He didn't have Book It. How sad is that? Did you guys out in our friends out in the listening world, did you guys have Book It through Pizza Hut? Because I know I did. Travis, did you have Book It? Like, I know we grew up 5 years apart, so I don't remember.
Is that where you read a certain number of books and you got a free personal pan pizza?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Good. So you had the good life as well.
Oh, and it was delicious.
I'm sorry that your childhood was crap, Will.
All four of those miniature slices. Oh, they were delicious.
I feel like my whole life is a lie.
Tasted like freedom and knowledge.
Uh-huh.
My world is built on a foundation of sand.
All right. So
I'm going to go cry. Hey, LD, sorry to step in here. We just have to take a few minutes for our sponsors. Okay, we are back.
Yay. I have finished talking about Michael Jackson. Now, when it comes to Billie Jean, a lot of people ask Michael about that song, and it's very simple. It is about a case of a girl who says Michael is the father of his child, and he is pleading innocence because the kid is not my son. Now, in reality, there never was a Billie Jean. The girl in the song is a composite of toxic people in Michael's life. And I think it's actually happened to his brothers multiple times. Because remember, Michael really wasn't like the sexual creature where his brothers are like, groupies! So the thing that he couldn't understand is how some of these girls could say that they were carrying somebody's child when it wasn't true. I mean, Michael is very sweet and very naive. He had pointed at times where people would actually show up at his house at the gate saying that, oh, I'm Michael's wife, or, yes. Oh, I'm just dropping off the keys to our apartment.
What Jason Momoa is dealing with right now, I'm sure.
You thirsty women, get off Jason Momoa. Stop it. You don't have 99.9% of this America doesn't have a chance with Jason Momoa. Do you even know what's going on, Travis?
I do know who he is. Well, I don't really know why he's famous, but I know who his wife is.
Or was.
It is so funny that you literally don't know why he's famous. He's like The Rock with hair.
Who's Khal Drogo?
He's
married.
I know who Khal Drogo is.
He's married to one of the Cosby kids.
He was.
Yep.
Up until like 6 days ago, and thirsty women everywhere were trying to slide into his DMs. And I'm like, guys, no.
Was the former Mrs. Lenny Kravitz, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, she sure was. I keep saying her build as Lisa Bonet. Didn't she change her name to Lilaqua Moon?
I don't know, because everything I ever see her name printed in is Lisa Bonet.
Yeah. I think at one point she changed her name to Lilaqua Moon.
Okay.
I don't think I've had enough beer to make that up.
Yet. So anyway, after that hard turn into Jason Momoa land, Michael can remember one girl who used to drive the family crazy. She honestly believed that she belonged with Michael. And then there was another woman who had claimed that he had gone to bed with her, and then she made some threats. Other people were just a bit weirder, like people who would come on the intercom screaming that Jesus sent them to be with Michael and God told them to come.
Huh.
Other unusual and unsettling things happened at this intercom, and eventually they had to have somebody stand out there and be like, guys, stop it. God did not send you to Michael Jackson's house. In his biography, I actually read a story that there was a teenager that was a little bit more persistent than most people. She loved Michael and claimed that she was supposed to be with him. She would write him and say that she couldn't stop thinking about them and how happy they would be when they got married and raised their children together. She was clearly disturbed. In the months to come, Michael would receive a dozen or more letters from this woman. And one, she claimed that the baby that she had, well, she was carrying and then subsequently had, was Michael's. And she was angry at Michael because they had similar eyes and wondered how he could ever ignore his own flesh and blood. The scariest thing about this woman was one day Michael received a package from her. When he opened it up, he had discovered another photograph. It was her high school graduation picture. Also in the box was a gun.
Oh my God.
Oh dear.
Yeah. In that note, she said that Michael should kill himself on a certain day at a certain time. And then she wrote that she would do the same thing right after she killed the baby.
Whoa.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, she had decided that if all three of them couldn't be together in life, perhaps they could be together in death.
Wow.
Yeah, Michael was horrified. She actually never showed up at Michael's gate. In fact, later he had learned that that poor woman had ended up in an insane asylum. So he wrote the song Billie Jean because he knew what it was like to go through that.
Well, that quite frankly, that sounds like where she needed to be.
And there's, I got to look up the name of this, but there is a condition where people are convinced that public figures, like they are supposed to be with that public figure. Like I knew someone in college who I believe it was their aunt was, and you might find this funny on the surface, but it's not, was convinced she was going to marry Huey Lewis.
Interesting.
And she ended up.
Wow. I actually find that really, really concerning because specifically, you know, back then it took work to be a fan of someone.
Oh yeah.
Like you had to join fan clubs. You had to actually like pay for tickets to see them in the show. You had to do. Now you can just look up TikTok. You can look up YouTube. You can look up Twitter and Instagram. You got all these different ways that you can see different facets of your favorite celebrity. Yeah. And now we think that we know these people because they let us into their lives. Yeah. Like I know a lot about Jeffree Star, the makeup influencer, because he puts out videos. I know the names of his dogs. I know where he, well, not specifically like his address, but I know he moved. I know he's a yak farmer. Like it would take so much to find that out back then in 1983 when there's absolutely no social media.
Agreed. And there is a, like you said, it's hard to insulate someone these days.
Yeah.
You know? And there is a mania. I think it's a mania. Is that what they call it?
Yes. I believe so.
Which any professionals, please weigh in, where someone is just utterly convinced that a public figure is, they're supposed to be with them. There's something that it's called.
Well, I mean, that's what John Hinckley Jr. thought he was supposed to be with Jodie Foster. Yeah. And so he tried to kill the president.
Yep.
Sure did.
Like
to impress her or something.
Yeah. To impress her because he thought that that's what she wanted.
Wow, it's just
It's all very Kathy Bates from Misery.
Oh, yes.
Accurate. Yeah. So now while working on it, Michael was confident that it was going to be a really big song. He got totally absorbed in that song. One day during a break in the recording session, he was riding down the Ventura Freeway with Nelson Hayes, who was working with him at the time. Billie Jean was going through his head, and that's all he was thinking about. So they pulled off on the freeway when a kid on a motorbike pulled up next to him and just said, "Your car's on fire." Suddenly.
I'm sorry. I don't know why, but I'm just hearing like Buckley from King of the Hill saying that, "Your car's on fire." I don't know why. I have no idea why that's how I heard that voice, but it was Buckley.
I didn't know that was a character, but yes, that's exactly how it sounded to me in my head as well. So you don't think you're far off.
Or Tony Shalhoub from Dallas Quest, FYI.
Your car's on fire.
Suddenly they noticed the smoke and pulled over and the whole bottom of the Rolls Royce was on fire.
Jeez.
That kid has saved his life because if the car had exploded, that probably would have killed them. But I don't think cars work that way. I don't think they just explode like they do in the movies, do they?
I've yet to hear about that happening.
Travis, you're in the news. Have you ever seen a car explode?
No, I've seen them burn.
Yeah.
And theoretically, they can explode. I mean, it's possible, but no, I've never actually seen that. I've seen several cars burn and I've never seen one blow up.
Yeah. Where in the movies, the hero like throws a paperclip and it's like kaboom.
Yeah. It's. I have seen the tires blow on cars when they're on fire. That's about as much of an explosion as I've seen before. So that's kind of the story of Billie Jean. All right. So hopping over to Beat It, that was actually written with school kids in mind. I always love creating pieces that will appeal to kids. It's fun to write for them and know what they like because they're a very demanding audience. You can't fool them. They are still the audience that is most important to me. And I don't think that ever changes as he gets older. Like he always likes creating things that might influence the younger generation. The lyrics to Beat It express that's something that he would do if he were in trouble. he is a pacifist, and it's basically his message that says that you should avoid violence. And that was something that Michael was really passionate about and cared really deeply about. He was trying to tell kids to be smart and avoid getting into trouble. If you fight and get killed, you've gained nothing and lost everything. And so does the family. And this echoes something that Joseph used to say, you're the loser, and so are the people who love you. And so that's what Michael was trying to get across. Now, if you guys know anything about Beat It, that it has a guitar riff, a very noticeable guitar riff.
Indeed, it does.
A very special guitar riff.
One that we discussed in part one of our Heavy Header series.
Yep.
One full year ago.
Ah, happy anniversary. It is very close to the hearts of one of our hosts here at Rock and Roll Heaven. And if you guys haven't figured it out, that guitar riff was done by Eddie Van Halen. Now, funny story about that. Eddie actually got a call from Quincy Jones. He thought it was a crank call. They had a bad connection, and he was convinced that the voice on the other end of the phone was a fake. So he slammed the phone down. And Quincy just kind of looked at the phone, hung it up, dialed the number again, and got Eddie to agree to play the session for Michael. And I think that we can all agree that it's probably one of the best guitar riffs in music history.
It's up there.
And two things, and we discussed both of these when we did a series on Eddie Van Halen last January. One, Eddie refused to accept payment of any kind. He was not, the extent of his compensation, as I understand it, was a case of beer. Instead of, you know, half an album point, which would have netted him, you know, $5 or $6 million. And then the other thing is, the whole thing took him like 20 minutes.
God.
He walked in, listened to it, actually reworked one whole part of the bridge of the song, he says. And he claimed Michael wasn't present when he did it. Then he played the solo and then he left. And that was that.
Yeah, well, since you love this song so much and the story behind it, I think we should listen to Beat It. So
absolutely we should.
So here you go, kids. From Thriller, here is Beat It. And we're back.
All right.
All right. I'm going to let Travis do his, what do you call it? Travis, share your opinion first, because I know you have thoughts.
Postulates on it.
Oh, it's a terrific song. Eddie's solo is fantastic. To think that he walked in there and in 20 minutes reworked part of the bridge and recorded that totally off, basically by feel and off the top of his head after listening to the song a time or two, or what they'd laid down of it up to that point. That's terrific.
Okay. And Mr. Thrill, what do you think?
Nailed it. No notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
So are you guys ready for a little bit of a fun fact?
Fun fact.
Okay. Now the famous guitar solo, which was, like we've talked about, originally done by Eddie Van Halen, was actually replicated in Weird Al Yankovic's parody for the song Eat It.
Huh.
Now, Eddie didn't step back into the studio for that. Actually, it was reproduced by Yankovic's producer, Rick Derringer. And according to Yankovic, when he presented his lyrics to Jackson for review, he didn't know what kind of reception he was going to get for it, but apparently Michael actually thought it was pretty amusing and agreed to allow the parody. Now, on October 19th, 1989, the RIAA, see, I told you I can say the words, but it's saying the acronym is so hard.
RIAA
certified Eat It as a gold single.
Nice.
Now, is that the Rick Derringer, like Rock and Roll Hoochie? Right,
Rock and Roll Hoochie, yeah. Too. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
I believe it is. Yeah.
Yep.
The
yep.
Same Rick Derringer.
Yep.
Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo.
Yep.
Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo.
That's the one. Yes, it is. Rick
so does Derringer. That mean they took the sample, or the song, the solo was redone by Weird Al's guitar player?
I think Rick reproduced it, as in he went into the studio and recorded it.
Oh, he did.
That's wow. How I'm reading it. Okay. I could be wrong.
It, no, wait, including the tapping portion?
Possibly, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So he kind of knows what he's doing. I mean, also though, like Weird Al's band could have also done that.
Yeah, so, I still argue to this day Jim West is a highly underrated guitar player, because he's had to duplicate everybody.
Yes. Yeah. He's an incredible guitar player. So all right. And this made me so happy when I read it, but I'm not gonna read it as a fun fact, because
not a fun fact.
All right. So they had hired some new members of the team to actually kind of be the backing band. And that band was actually Toto.
those guys were one of the best studio bands going, and they played with just about everybody.
Yeah, but my number one song on Spotify last year, 2021, was Toto. It was Africa.
Which does tie in with Weird Al there as well, isn't there?
No, Weezer.
Well, he was, wasn't he part of that?
No, I don't.
In the video? I thought Weird Al was in the video.
No, Weezer. He was a part of Weezer.
When they covered it, right?
Yes. Weezer covered Africa's Toto, and they used Weird Al Yankovic in the music video to stand in for Rivers Cuomo, I think?
I believe so, yes.
I have to rewatch it, because, I mean, like...
It's fantastic.
I'm totally fine with that. Yeah. Now, if you guys don't know who the band Toto are, shame on you. They had hits like Rosanna and Africa. And speaking of Africa, Somewhere in Africa is the 11th album released in 1982 by Manfred Mann's Earth Band.
Who gets to do it?
I think T gets to do it this time.
Oh, T, go ahead.
You did it last time.
Ladies and gentlemen, the federally mandated Manfred Mann's Earth Band reference of the Rock and Roll Heaven podcast has now been satisfied.
Oh, you sound like a creepy... like security guard.
I like how
what are you wearing?
Oh, stop it.
TJ's a combination of like Wolfman Jack and the guy from Scream. And I sound like more like the person who comes out at the beginning of the Broadway show, like, please unwrap your gum now. we all have our different approaches.
I just actually, for a second, like being serious about our Manfred Mann's Earth Band reference of this podcast, I literally just told you that it was that album, Africa, was released in 1982.
Toto's album?
Yeah. No, Manfred Mann's.
Oh, Manfred Mann's album. Okay.
Africa.
Okay.
Somewhere in Africa.
Out of Africa, yes.
Somewhere in Africa.
Somewhere in Africa, correct.
Yes. What year are we in now?
Well, Thor came out in 80, is that right?
No, 82.
82, okay.
Yeah, it's about to be just stopped.
We made it to the 80s.
We're in the 80s. We're deep into the 80s. We're good. We're in the 80s, baby. Now, they were well known as individual session musicians before. Like, Manfred Mann, Toto, were well-known individual session musicians before they came together as a group. So PYT, or Pretty Young Thing, was written by Quincy and James Ingram, someone else we've actually covered on this podcast, because he sadly passed away right when we were actually starting up this show. So he actually invited his sisters, Janet and LaToya, into the studio for that song, and they produced the real backup vocals that you hear. They also programmed an electronic device called a vocoder, which gave out that funky sounding vocals that you hear. That
it's a vocoder?
Yeah, it's a vocoder. And one of my favorite songs of all time is Human Nature.
Mm.
That was the song that Toto brought to Quincy, and both of them agreed that the song had the prettiest melody, but they actually thought that it was even prettier than Africa. Steve wrote the song when his first grade daughter came home crying after a boy pushed her off a slide. He blurted out the reason for the incident to comfort her. He said the boy liked her, people could be strange, and it's human nature. He recorded a rough demo of the song in the studio while they were working on Africa, and that was in the mixing process. So he was like, well, while you guys are mixing this, I'm going to lay this down. So he laid the demo down. Originally, the song was actually offered to Toto, but they passed on it because they preferred that stadium rock-oriented material and sound. The Lady in My Life was one of the more difficult tracks to cut. They were used to doing a lot of takes in order to get the vocals perfect as possible, but Quincy wasn't satisfied with Michael's work on that song, even after literally a dozen takes. Finally, he took Michael aside one night and told him that he wanted him to beg. That's what Michael's verbatim said in his book. He said, he wanted me to go back into the studio and literally beg for it. So I went back in and turned off all the studio lights, and they closed the curtains between the studio and the control room so I wouldn't feel so conscious. Q started the tape and I begged. The results is what you hear in the grooves. Now, the process for this album was taking a really long time. So eventually they were under pressure for the record company to finish Thriller. They said that it had to be ready by a certain date, do or die. So they were breaking their backs to get this album done by the record label's basically arbitrary deadline. And in Michael's opinion, there were a lot of compromises made on the mixes and various tracks and whether or not certain tracks would even end up on the album. They had cut so many corners that they almost lost the whole album.
Oh,
and holy cow, wouldn't the world have been much different if that would have happened?
Be a lesser place.
Yeah. When they finally listened to the tracks that they were going to hand in, Thriller sounded so crappy that tears came to Michael's eyes. It sounded terrible. And he was crushed. Michael was absolutely crushed. He had worked so hard on this, and the mixes sounded terrible. Now, to solve this problem, each of them had to be remixed, bringing up a level on some orchestrations and toning down voices in others. And it was time-consuming and tedious work. And I actually read somewhere that it would take a week or so for each song.
That's a long time.
Yeah, 9 to 10 extra weeks. Quincy, along with some of his managers, Ron Weisner, and his attorney, John Branca, sat with Michael, and he was in the studio, and they were listening to the playback to the album. Michael was elated because it sounded so much better, and he was so optimistic. When Ron turned to him and said, Mike, you know that the record market is off right now. Quincy agreed with him. He said, you can't expect to do with this one what you did with Off the Wall. Ron added that at the time, 2 million would have been great for any album to sell. Quincy kind of, you know, bounced off that ideology, saying that it was a tough market and that nobody was having any hits. Turn it down, Michael said to the engineer. The music kept playing. He turned his head and screamed, I said, turn it down. He demanded to know what was wrong with these guys. His smile that he had beforehand was completely gone. He was so angry that the people that he entrusted didn't think that he'd be able to succeed. And Michael stormed out of the studio. He was so upset the next day that he called his attorney, John, and told him that he was so angry that Ron and Quincy predicted that Thriller would only sell 2 million copies. He insisted that John call Walter, who was the president of Epic CBS, and told him that the record was canceled. He wasn't even going to submit it to CBS. He was going to pull the plug himself, because if the two people that he trusted, like Quincy and Ron, didn't have the faith in him, there wasn't any reason to put it out to the public. He would rather have it go unheard rather than it not get the attention and respect it deserved.
Oof.
Upon hearing this, Walter himself called up Michael. And according to Walter's memory, when Michael told him what occurred in the studio, he tried to calm him down by saying, what the hell do they know? You're the superstar, not them. Jesus, Michael, we trust you. Not Quincy. All due respect to the guy and certainly none of your managers, but you're the superstar. And after a little bit more buttering up, Michael finally said that the record was able to be released. Now, there is some speculation about whether or not he really would have canceled the release simply because of Quincy's prediction, but more likely he was just trying to get his way. It was more strategic than anything else. You have to remember that if you come from a big family, you have to make a lot of noise to get noticed.
Also, he's under contract.
Yeah, I mean, but he can say, I don't believe in this. I don't want this.
It's still a risky
move. But he'd also have to pay for it.
Exactly.
So now I have two dates released, but I'm going to go with the book version because several online sources stated that it was released on November 30th, but the biography states that it was released on the 1st of December, 1982. It was released to a market of seasonal shoppers, but it's funny that it was released prior to Christmas because literally the title track is so ingrained in the Halloween season that if they had released it a month before, it might have actually garnered even more success.
Yeah, it should have been October release.
But the first single was The Girl Is Mine, like we talked about, because, you know, they want to get that out of the way and let the other songs have a chance to breathe. Then came Billie Jean. And then there was the funky You Want to Be Starting Something, which kind of sounds like A Distant Relative to Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, and Working Day and Night. The reason why they all kind of sound the same in that little genre was they were all written at the same time. It was when he was working, I believe, on Triumph that he wrote that little string of songs.
So they all were the
same time frame. Want to Be Starting Something climaxes in a Swahili-like chant, which gives the song a little bit more of an international flavor. According to Music Match, and that's music with an X, I think, the lyrics are "Mama, mama, mama, say, mama, mama, say, mama, 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 say, mama, say, mama, mama, kusa." Now, the thing is, I can't do it. It's Michael Jackson. No one can sing Michael Jackson. Only Michael can. So anyway,
I just did. I sang the hell out of it. Those are some fine vocals.
I feel like this is actually one of Michael's angrier songs. And then the reason why I looked up the lyrics is because people are like, oh, no, it means this. Oh, no, it means this. Oh, if you translate it, it means this. It's like, no, apparently, mama say, mama sa, mama kusa. Why can't I do that? It's like R-I-A-A. Oh, come on. Anyway, it's just those lyrics. It doesn't really mean anything. But I feel like this is one of Michael's angrier songs because he was talking about feeling like a vegetable and pain being thunder. So I think it's more of his like angrier, darker songs. But we haven't talked about one of the songs yet. The title track.
Title of the song.
Thriller. The song was as much about Michael's fascination with the supernatural and the lurid as it was just being a friggin' banger. Thriller was actually not written by Michael.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. It was Ron Temperton, who had previously had written for his 79 album, Off the Wall. Ron wanted to write something theatrical to suit Jackson's love of film. He improvised with a bass and drum pattern till he developed a bass line that runs through the song, and then wrote a chord progression to build to a climax. He recalled, I wanted it to build and build a bit like a stretching elastic band throughout the tune to heighten suspense. Now, remember that fun fact that I told you guys beforehand?
Fun fact you told us before.
About how it was titled Starlight?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Starlight was actually the original title for Thriller, the song.
Huh.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
With the chorus lyric, give me some starlight, starlight sun. The production team led by Quincy Jones felt like the song should be the title track, but that Starlight wasn't a strong album title. Instead, they wanted something mysterious to match Michael's evolving persona. Templeton considered several possible titles, including Midnight Man, which Jones felt was going in the right direction, but not exactly there. He finally conceived a Thriller, but worried that it was a crap word to sing because in his opinion, it sounded terrible. However, he got Michael to spit it into the microphone a couple times and it worked. With the title settled, Temperton wrote lyrics within a couple hours. He envisioned the spoken word sequence for the end of the song, but did not know what form it should take. He decided to have a famous voice from the horror genre. And so Jones's then wife, Peggy Lipton, suggested her friend, Vincent Price.
Yes.
Temperton was composing the words for Vincent's part in a taxi on the way to the studio on the day of recording. But you literally can't talk about the album without talking about the song, and we can't talk about the song without talking about the music video. And I'm going to go ahead and say up top, I hate John Landis with a burning passion that is only matched by the fiery depths of the sun. And I have basically told him that to his face.
Yes, you had an encounter with John
Landis. I had an encounter with John Landis. I have never felt more satisfied walking out of a Bob's Big Boy. Anyway.
The Bob's Big Boy, correct?
It's the Bob's Big is the first one. So yeah, now that I've got that off my chest, I can move on. Michael Jackson's Thriller is a 1983 music video for the same song, Thriller, which was released in 1983 in December. It was one of the later ones that was released, because remember, the album was released almost a year prior to the release of the single. The video is directed by John Landis and written by Landis and Jackson. Anyway, and it stars Ola Ray. It references numerous horror films and sees Jackson dancing with a horde of zombies. Jackson's sixth album was released in 1982 and spent months at the top of the Billboard charts, backed by the successful videos for things like Billie Jean and Beat It. Now, Frank DeLeo suggested making a music video for Thriller. Jackson hired Landis after seeing his 1981 film, An American Werewolf in London.
Which is a great movie.
It is, to be fair.
I have not actually seen it. I've only seen the transfer. I've actually only seen the transformation scene, because we watched that in our film class, which
special effects by Rick Baker, I believe.
And he also does the special effects for this, and he does almost the same transformation for Michael.
And the thing that we've lamented time and time again, LD, is the fact that, yes, you hate John Landis, and the reasons are solid. He's attached to some just, I mean, amazing projects. That's the thing.
Yeah, but he's not.
His products
this,
are well.
This is a yeah. This is a.
It's like an episode in
a conversation now. For another day. Which I mean, like, I've got a really good steady heart rate right now, and if I talk about John Landis, I'm just gonna like get angrier and break something. And we're almost done with this episode, and we're doing really good. So please, let's just walk away from John Landis.
Fair.
All right. So anyway, the pair conceived it as a short film with a budget much larger than not just previous music videos of Michael's, but a budget higher than some films that were produced.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely the most expensive music video of all time, up until, I do believe, when he released Scream.
So you got the biggest two.
I want to say that Express Yourself by Madonna eclipsed it for a while, and then Scream reestablished Michael as having the most expensive opulent video of anybody.
Probably.
Yeah, you're probably not wrong, but I don't remember Express Yourself eclipsing it, but also I didn't do any sort of like side quest to try to find that out.
but certainly at the time, nobody had ever spent this much money on a video.
No.
Jump by Van Halen cost $5,000, and which apparently half of that was for beer.
I mean, yeah, I think after this music video really hit, I think artists realized, oh, this is actually a very viable way to get our music out to the masses, because MTV had just launched.
Well, this raised the bar considerably, for sure. I want to say MTV launched in 80 or 81, but a lot of the videos they showed were just old performance clips that had been recorded for shows like
Top of the Pops
and Dick Cavett and people like that.
Yeah.
And there were very few artists using it as a form of real art.
Exactly.
Like, oh, look, Bowie did very early, actually predating MTV even, I think, the Ashes for Ashes.
The Ashes for Ashes. And it also, that Ashes for Ashes did cost a pretty penny as well, if I remember correctly.
Which is a shame, because look at it, really.
It was filmed in various locations in Los Angeles, including the Palace Theater. I actually had a friend who lived in the house that was the house that the demons break into, the zombies break into.
Wait, lives there?
Rachel.
Really?
Rachel rented part of the house. I actually never got to see it, which is a shame. I probably need to like go on a little journey. But there was a making of documentary, The Making of Michael Jackson's Thriller, which was produced to sell to television networks. Now, the thing is, Epic was like, we're not paying for this music video. And so they made that documentary and sold it. And that's how they got their money back for it. Thriller was launched to great anticipation. And I mean, great anticipation. Watching this music video was an event. I remember, it is one of my earliest friggin' memories was watching that music video. Do you remember when it came out, T?
Vaguely. I don't even think we had MTV. It seems like we saw it through some other means.
I think we did. I think they might have aired it on CBS at some point, because it is CBS. So
yeah, we saw it somewhere else for sure. But yeah, I do remember it.
And it's interesting, because this album, or that music video, actually got heavy rotation on MTV, which is interesting, because remember, we just spoke about David Bowie had to speak out against the racism that, or the bias, I guess, bias and racism that MTV was showing against Black artists.
That interview is still, the interview is so
satisfying. So it doubled the sales of Thriller, helping it to become the best-selling album in history. And that cassette sold over 1 million copies on VHS, becoming the best-selling videotape at the time. It is credited for transferring music videos into a serious art form, breaking down racial barriers in popular entertainment, and popularizing the making of documentary format. This successfully transferred Jackson into a dominant force in global pop culture. Many elements of Michael Jackson's Thriller has had a lasting impact on popular culture, such as the zombie dance, which I don't know if you guys remember this, but like right when YouTube came out, do you remember the prisoners in the, I think it was a Bangladesh prison, did the Thriller dance?
In the Philippines.
Is it was a prison in the Philippines. And they all did the dance. And then of course you had Jackson's red jacket, which was designed by John Landis's wife, Deborah. I don't have a problem with Deborah. She's fine. Fans worldwide reenacted the zombie dance, and it remains popular on YouTube. The Library of Commerce describes it as the most famous music video of all time, and it has been named the greatest video by various publications and readers' poll. And in 2009, it became the first music video to be inducted into the National Film Registry as culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
Nice.
All right. You guys ready for a round of pseudo rapid fire fun facts?
Rapid fire fun facts.
All right. The video cost $500,000. At the time, it was the most expensive video ever made, but CBS Records wouldn't pay for it because they didn't want to make a third video from the album Thriller. So they had a policy of never paying for clips. So Landis and Jackson funded their budget by getting MTV and Showtime to pay $250,000 each for the rights to show the 45-minute making of Thriller video. So MTV reasoned that they were actually paying for a movie, not clips. All right. Now, another fun fact. Jackson's Thriller co-star is a former Playboy playmate.
Huh.
Ola Ray also appeared in Cheers and in Beverly Hills Cop 2, but this is her only music video. Well, it was this one and Gimme the Night by George Benson, which was also written by Rod Temperton.
I totally forgot she was in Beverly Hills Cop. I totally forgot that. Wow.
Another fun fact. All right. Hollywood legend Fred Astaire was a massive fan of Jackson's dancing, and we will actually talk about that in the next episode. He attended a Thriller rehearsal. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, who edited Jackson's Moonwalk autobiography, logged some serious hours. While they were filming at 3 a.m. in a bad neighborhood in East Los Angeles, she was actually hanging out in Jackson's Winnebago, which is super weird.
There's a lot going on there.
There's so much going on there. As a 9-year-old child, CeeLo Green was so scared of Thriller that he would flee the room anytime the video came on TV. He thought if he could be possessed, then he would surely be possessed because Michael Jackson was so much stronger than he was. All right. And then horror legend Vincent Price, which, I mean, we all know House of Wax, Edward Scissorhands. He's a Hollywood legend. Recorded his spoken word. He actually did a whole verse that got cut. And I found something so incredible that I have to play it for you guys right now. This is actually considered the lost rap by Michael Jackson and Vincent Price. And I'm going to go ahead and say, you're welcome. And I'm playing the whole thing. And it's like less than 3 minutes.
Okay, tape rolling. Anytime you want.
Hi, this is Michael Jackson.
This is Vincent Price. Michael Jackson is...
the Thriller. Do we both say it?
Say it together. I say inviting you to. All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Anytime. Test roll.
Hi, this is Michael Jackson.
And this is Vincent Price inviting you to...
The Thriller.
Darkness falls across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize y'all's neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell. The demons squeal in sheer delight. It's you they spy, so plump, so right. For though the groove is hard to beat, yet still you stand with frozen feet. You try to run, you try to scream, but no more sun you'll ever see. For evil reaches from the crypt to crush you in its icy grip. The foulest stench is in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist the evil of the thriller. Can you dig it? It's great fun.
Great banger. Cut.
Okay. All right.
How awesome is that?
That's fantastic.
It's the greatest thing we've ever played on this show.
Ever. Okay, so a couple of things. One, I guess I kind of get why they would have had to chop that, because the song is already very long.
Mm-hmm.
It's already a very long song. And so you could kind of understand, like, maybe two stanzas of this instead of three is okay. But I hate that they cut out the Can You Dig It?
Yeah, that's painful.
At least we still have it.
It exists, but yeah, I wish Can You Dig It would have made the song.
Yeah. Samesies. So now going back to the album, because I think you guys know what the end song is going to be for this episode.
It's Uncle Arthur, right?
No,
spray ball.
Did we learn a lesson? Yeah,
clearly not.
Now, the thing is, Thriller isn't a concept album, but if they had kept the title track and created a concept album, it would have been really interesting. But the album doesn't have an actual focus. So where I think like Destiny and Triumph with the Jacksons were no filler, had a through line, really well balanced. This one wasn't as focused. It's literally just an album of incredible songs.
Mm-hmm.
Even the album's cover art is just a photo of Michael casually posed in a white jacket and pants, but it's a picture that most people will refer to when people talk about his plastic surgery, basically keeping with that idea that if he had just stopped there, he would have been fine.
Got it.
Once it was released, there was a point where the album stopped selling like it was a leisure item, like a toy or a ticket to a movie or new shoes, and it started selling like bread and milk, like things that you can't live without. CBS would report that the album was selling an astonishing 500,000 copies a week.
Jeez.
And of course, there's Quincy saying, oh yeah, I knew it was going to be a hit the whole time, because that's the thing, is like, even when they did their Vegas show and they said, okay, you're not going to get any backing from Motown, and it became successful, and then Barry was like, oh, we believed in him the whole time. Like, I hate that hypocrisy. By the end of 1983, Thriller would sell a staggering 13 million copies in the U.S.
That's insane.
Nearly 22 million copies worldwide. And at the time, it was the best-selling album.
And here's the thing. The legs that it had were remarkable, because it held the number one spot in 1984 for a long time.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get to that.
Insane.
But it actually knocked off the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever, which had a worldwide selling of 25 million since its release in 1977. And the release of Thriller actually had a domino effect to the record industry as a whole, because people would go to the store to buy Thriller and they'd end up purchasing other records. So as a result, the business had its best year since 1978.
Jeez.
The president of AM Records, A&M is not even have anything to do with Epic. It has nothing to do with CBS. They said at the time that the entire music industry had a stake in Thriller's success.
That's crazy that it was actually creating ripples with other records.
Yes. Ultimately, Thriller would go on to sell. Okay. And then this is where we might get letters. I'm going to throw out many numbers as what it possibly could have sold. Okay. It sold more than 50 million copies worldwide. It would spend 37 weeks at the number one spot on the Billboard charts. And in the UK, it would stay on the charts for 168 weeks. It did hit number one. I didn't actually back check if it was number one for 168 weeks, because that seems like
I don't think that's accurate now.
Yeah. Okay. So it stayed on the charts. It did hit number one in the UK, but it actually stayed on the charts for 168 weeks. Funny enough, the release of Thriller marked the first time that an album was number one in the US and the UK at the same time. Also, prior to Thriller, no other album had spawned 7 top 10 singles.
Wow.
7 top 10 singles. Those were Billie Jean, Beat It, The Girl Is Mine, Human Nature, Wanna Be Starting Something, PYT, and Thriller. All of those songs sold a massive amount on their own right around the world. The album won a record-breaking 8 Grammy Awards at the 26th Grammy Awards, including Album of the Year. Yay! Woo-hoo. Jackson won 7 of the Grammy Awards, with the 8th going to Bruce Sweden. That same year, Michael won 8 American Music Awards, including the American Music Awards of Merit, and 3 MTV Video Music Awards. Thriller was recognized as the best-selling album of all time on February 7th, 1984, when it was inducted into the Guinness Book of World Records. Now, what I am about to tell you guys comes from the Guinness Book of World Records website, okay? According to the Guinness Book of World Records, sales figure vary, but Thriller has exceeded the 66 million mark. I'm going to say that with bunny ears because there are so many different numbers, some of them as high as 100 million, some as low as 32. So I'm going to say the number 66 because that's what Guinness notes when they honored him with the award.
For number of albums sold?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was also...
Well, until SoundScan came along in about 1991, everything was kind of an estimate, frankly.
Yeah, but, spitballing, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean the record company would certainly know how many they pressed and shipped.
Right.
But sales is kind of like, who knows? The fact that you have a range of between 32 and 100 million kind of let you know that we're guessing, we really have no idea.
Yeah. And the other thing was that there was also a surge in his sales after he passed away, so even after he died, sure, there was still that interest, and so people were still purchasing. So what is not in contention is that it has been certified 29 times platinum by the Recording Industries Association of America, or the RIAA.
Yes! LD did it!
Which was a figure that was matched by the Eagles for their greatest hits, 1971 and 1975. The two titles, therefore, share the record for best-selling album in the U.S. That's where we're ending the episode. Do you guys have any passing thoughts?
Not really, other than, I mean, this is, you almost can't, if you weren't alive then, and we were all very young. Y'all were, you know, children, babies just about. I wasn't even 10 years old at the time, but it's the impact that this had was just so colossal on every front. And in a lot of ways, in terms of, you almost just kind of laid it out that the rising tide raises all boats, that other record companies were benefiting from this because there were increased sales of everything, because people go to buy Michael Jackson's album. They're like, oh, I've heard good things about this Springsteen fellow. Oh, this Footloose album I hear has a good soundtrack. Why don't I pick that up? So there's that. But then there's the cultural impact that he has, which was like a freaking bomb going off in terms of the fact that, let's just be honest, he was about the first Black artist that MTV would play in primetime or not at 2 a.m.
Yep.
And that kind of permeated really beyond MTV in a lot of ways, I would say. The cultural impact of this was titanic. I mean, you almost can't overstate how big it was in every way, really.
Yep.
And we'll never see anything like it again, ever.
I know they say
that. I will say the closest thing that we might have had was Beyonce's Lemonade. Like,
no.
I mean, you aren't part of that generation, though. The newer generation coming up were eating out of the palm of Beyonce's hand. I would say,
but not, but see, but
let's say there were very few. Yes, it was huge. I'm not arguing that. But in terms of the cultural impact it had in so many ways, you almost can't replicate that now. You certainly can't replicate the sales. Nobody will ever sell that many albums ever again, ever, because people don't buy albums just for starters, you know.
Yep.
But it was just, yeah, I mean, it was, the world was very different then. I mean, you're talking 40 years ago.
Yeah.
There were still a lot of racial walls up that he really kicked down, tremendously so. It was, in every sense, that album was just unbelievable what it accomplished.
Yeah. And then, Will, you wanted to weigh in?
We hit the major points there. The fact that, you know, they talk about the wall, you know, Run DMC and Aerosmith breaking it down. But this was a scale that eclipses that on every level. It's an international phenomenon. It's a worldwide phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Done by a Black artist. We cannot overstate that. It is impossible to do. Also, TJ, you know what you alluded to? You went to the store and you bought the album. Mm-hmm. That's what you did. So even in today's market, like you said, that couldn't be replicated because digital sales and all that. Just, again, that hysteria surrounding one artist of people just flocking to these stores and buying en masse is just, it's unfathomable.
And it is.
Finally, the relevance that it still has today. I mean, if you go to any bar on Halloween, if you listen to any radio station on Halloween, if you do anything on Halloween, you are going to hear it from.
Yes. Yep.
You will hear that song. It's relevant even today on a massive scale. And I
remember when my cousin got it for his birthday, maybe birthday, Christmas, somewhere in there, some occasion. And God, we listened to that thing over and over and over. And I couldn't count the number of times we listened to that album start to finish.
I mean, Michael Jackson has just always been in my life. And so that album, it's in my record player right now.
Yes, it is.
I would turn my camera on, walk you to the bedroom and show you my record player. It is sitting on the turntable right now.
I'll post it to socials. How about that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's totally good. Yeah. Cause that's how important that album is to me. It is something I have access to in my everyday life. And I'd rather listen to it on vinyl than I would on my phone. But I went to the store and I bought the album, which just doesn't really happen anymore. All right. So I think that is a good close of the show, guys. I'm going to give out our socials. Join us next week where we are probably only literally going to talk about one event. Again, because I belong to Michael.
Because Bob. Pacing is not your strong suit.
Shut up.
Michael Jackson goes to a Pizza Hut. That's next episode.
It wasn't a Pizza Hut. It was a Shoney's.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was Showbiz. It was Showbiz, Will.
Showbiz Pizza, where a kid can be a kid.
My mistake.
Anyway.
Or Godfathers. But it was one of those.
Will actually did mention that he was going to post something on our socials. So I'm going to give that out right now, and then we will say goodnight. So if you think we're doing an awesome job and you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/rockandrollheaven. You can check out our Twitter at rockandrollLT, our Instagram, rockandrollheavenLT, Facebook, rockandrollheavenpod, still not staying on our website. You can email us at rockandrollheavenLT@gmail.com. And if I went too fast, you can check everything out in the show notes. And also, please make sure that you're listening to all the other awesome Pantheon podcasts at pantheonpodcast.com. And you can still get your tea fix at TST and use our code ROCKHEAVEN15 to get 15% off at checkout. Woo! All right. So that's it for the show tonight. T, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Bye, everybody.
All right. Mr. Will the Thrill.
Toodles.
All right. So, to wrap up this episode, I figured that there was probably no question as to what was actually going to be the song I end with.
Uncle Arthur. No, put the bottle down. Jesus. You think I'd learn by now.
Yeah, but you don't, which is weird.
Clearly I do not.
So we're going to end this on one of the highest notes that Michael will ever...
No, that does not destroy a bottle. Jeez. I'm just... That was a spraying of the monitor.
So we're going to close out tonight with, is there any question? Do I even have to say it?
Are you going to spray me again? I don't know.
I'm just going to say, we're closing out with Thriller, guys. Enjoy. It doesn't have the third refrain, but it doesn't have the second part of Vincent Price's magnum opus, but it does have at least two parts of that. So we're going to close out tonight with Michael Jackson's A Thriller, and make sure to check us out next week when we talk about Motown 25. All right, guys. Have a great week. We will see you next time. We love you all. Mwah.
For no mere mortal can resist the evil. If you're looking to get a new car, you could really cut expenses by bundling your car and renter's insurance with Progressive. Sure, you love your old car, but you know it's not normal to give instructions on how to open the window. It should be self-explanatory, but it's not. And notice how when you're in other people's cars, you can feel cushion in the seats? That's pretty nice, right? No, it's just normal. So bundle your renter's and car insurance with Progressive and put the savings toward a new car. It's time. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company coverage provided in service by affiliates and third-party insurers.
The Venture X card from Capital One gives you premium travel benefits, perfect for seeing Taylor Swift the Eras Tour, presented by Capital One. Ooh, I do love her. Earn 5x miles on flights and 10x miles on hotels through Capital One Travel.
Enjoy your stay in Suite 13.
Whoa, 13? That's Taylor's lucky number. The Venture X card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.